slightly big because
get around everywhere, the voice activated, the switch had flipped over.
Ah, okay.
Oh.
Well, if it was voice activated, it should have been picking it up while we were talking then.
Yeah, see, I was sitting here listening, and there's a little light that is supposed to flash off and on,
yeah.
And I, one of the things that in reading on how to do these interviews, they said, don't pay attention to your recorder. So I tried not to look at it, and I looked down, there was no red light on it.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, something wrong here.
Let's hope it was a lull in the conversation.
Yeah, so let me just recap quickly. You started at Boston College, I mean University of Nevada, then to Boston, then...
No, University of Nevada, where I got my undergraduate degree, 4-year tour in the Navy during World War II. Then came back after the war, finished my degree at the University of Nevada, went to Rutgers University to do my doctorate. I'd been at the University of Minnesota on a summer activity. And finished my doctorate in 1950, took a first faculty position at George Washington University in Washington, D.C. Did a year's research in the Arctic, on the Arctic slope of Alaska, and went to Boston University Physical Research Laboratory, then came to Michigan State in 1954. So the university college was then called Basic College, and my first exposure to it was trying to articulate what was going on in Basic College with my undergraduate advisees, and I had a hassle of them at the time, and also to try to guide some of these people in preparation to go on to graduate school. So my acquaintance with it came really from that kind of an exposure. And then, as I indicated, Irving Knobloch in our department had just he was one of the original faculty members that were brought together to make the Basic College. He taught the basic plant sciences in it. And he was becoming a kind of an internal critic on the consolidation portion that was then getting, had gotten underway, I guess, a couple of years earlier. And I think consolidated examinations and that, so on. So he was kind of a critic of it. And finally, they invited him to go back to his home department, which he did, and joined the department. So again, this was my early familiarity with Basic College. Then we of course, became friends with a number of the faculty members there, Manny Hackle being one of them. And several others, mostly in the natural science side, since my field is biology. Then in 1965-66, I went to Washington, D.C. as a program director in the National Science Foundation and ran the environmental biology panel and program there. When I came back to campus, in late 66, I had a major graduate program going, research program underway, and in 1969 I was appointed provost and served as provost and chief academic officer from 1969 through 1975. So in those 6 years, several things happened, one of which was the university college faculty was essentially the home of the faculty unionization attempt. And so it sort of focused attention on it as a critic of the university, in a sense, and a critic of the faculty status. And I presume that sort of feeling sort of polarized the rest of the faculty, because only about a third of Michigan State's faculty thought collective bargaining was a good idea, and they were sort of the hotbed of the interest in it. And so that was one element that focused attention on, by then, University College.
When did it switch over to University College?
Well, my guess, and this is a guess, that's certainly you can verify it with some of the records. Hunter could help you unravel them. But my guess would be somewhere in the late 50s or early 60s that the switch from Basic College to University College. I was on the Educational Policies Committee back in the 60s, and looking at university curricula. We were setting up the three residential colleges at that time. So I was very much involved in that, and I also served on the Graduate Council during those years. And I think that the exposure to setting up the three residential colleges got me focusing on the concept of a total degree program and an integrated degree program. And I think the involvement in the Graduate Council got me focused pretty much on the relationship of undergraduate degrees to graduate degrees in ways that you wouldn't as a normal faculty member be thinking about. And then in my 6 years as provost, I got focused on it from the standpoint of being chief academic officer and concerned about the whole general health of the faculty on a campus and the general quality of the undergraduate program. So that, in a sort of a nutshell, is the situation. In 1975, after serving 6 years as provost, Milt Mulder, who had been the first vice president for research development, was his title, and graduate dean, retired. Actually retired in late 74. And we had conducted a search to fill this position. And the search ground on about like it's grinding on for my replacement. And the first group of candidates we got here, none of the individuals that we really wanted to take the job could we attract. We had some really major national types here, and either they were not enamored of Michigan's winters, which was a couple of them, or else they had other offers in mind, and one of them went into industry and one went into government. But we were unsuccessful in getting it. So I told Cliff Wharton, I said, geez, Cliff, I'm better qualified than any of the remaining candidates for that job, and I'd much rather have that job than the one I'm in. So having run a search cycle, it's very difficult to go back and redo a search cycle. You've kind of muddied the waters in the field. Yeah. So I came down here then as vice president for research, and we changed the title at the time from research development and dean of the graduate school. And I wanted a separate dean, so we brought Herb Boyer in. And by the way, you might want to talk to Herb Boyer. He's down at Columbus. He lives in Columbus. Herb Boyer was head of the Department of Audiology and Speech Sciences. Then he was, I guess, the second dean of the new College of Communication Science and Arts.
No, there's another Herb Boyer, because what I'm thinking of is in the Ohio Department of Education, and just left for South Carolina.
Oh.
I see you said that one.
Yeah.
You know, don't come again. Another.
Well, maybe it's his son. He has a son, I think, whose name is Herbert, but I'm not certain of that. his wife, Jane Oyer, was a faculty member in human ecology, and they live in Columbus, so you ought to be able to run them down. You're not too far away. But you could get his view, you see, because he was graduate dean at the time the final dismemberment took place. All right, well, now let's sort of sketch, this is all record. Now let me sketch hypothesis or theory, which I wouldn't assert are facts, but it's my impression of what the situation was. And I would put it into three categories. One is the sort of ontogeny or development of the basic college, which was Hannah's starting point. The emergence of the three residential colleges, which gave an opportunity to look at the concept of an integrated education, not as basic college, but as a full set. That was multi-tiered integration, as opposed to only integrating in the beginning year or two. And then a separate, a very separate dimension of this, and that is sort of administrative run university, which was the world that Hannah visualized, was gradually undergoing change as the faculty improved in quality, assertiveness, and so on. More and more faculty governance kind of things came into being. And that process got exacerbated by the collective bargaining concept, which, as I say, became almost headquartered in the university college. And so the them and us relationship between faculty and administration began to grow. Then there was the sort of third element that the faculty members in the university college probably had some of the heaviest teaching assignments in the university. They were largely undergraduate teachers. Very few of them participated in any graduate programs. The few that did were not looked upon charitably by their colleagues, Manny Hackle being one of them.
Which is partly because of the union stuff as well?
Well, no, I think it's common in many universities that people who are really committed as undergraduate teachers find the different lifestyle of a person who's largely involved in scholarly activity a very, very different thing. And for one thing, you don't have that highly time-structured thing that the class and grading papers and meeting with students, you know, that just inundate your life. And having been a very, very active and involved undergraduate teacher, my first really almost my first 10 years here, I can tell you that in an institution of our size, class sizes and so on, you get your day really structured. And so their lifestyle is different. You're just beat at the end of a day when you work with that many students. And you get a researcher now, you know, you're and I've lived in both of the worlds, and I can tell you that the researcher's activity, even though it's a very demanding kind of style, it's different. You don't have as much noise that other people generate. You, in a sense, are looking, and you almost close out the rest of the world while you pursue whatever your hypothesis or idea or experiments, whatever it is. And so you simply don't allow that kind of thing. Otherwise, you can't keep your mind ordered enough to pursue whatever you're trying to address. So the lifestyles are very, very different. And many faculty members have a foot in both camps. They're undergraduate teacher part of the day, but you've got to keep that within bounds. You can't have three courses that you're responsible for every term and then have a substantial scholarly life. It's just impossible.
I never really understood that until this year. I really got deeply involved in my dissertation as well, becoming superintendent of the school. And you're right, it's impossible.
Yeah, you just can't do it.
The one is the noise. That's the best definition I've ever heard, the noise.
Yeah.
You're doing scholarly work, you can't.
You can't do it.
I never realized that till now.
Yeah. So that, in a sense, the culture of the university college is essentially the culture of a community college, where your job is to teach youngsters, to advise youngsters, to design curricula, and that swallows your whole creative energies. And then you have a university moving toward AAU status. We weren't AAU, you see. And so the drive of quality of research and scholarly programs and so on was essentially the ordering theme of the day. Dick Byram you should definitely see. Dick Byram was dean of the College of Natural Sciences. He was the senior dean, just retired last year, and he's over in the Department of Biochemistry. And Dick was also assistant provost to Jake Neville. So as the he was very much involved. Might even have been there when Erickson was in. I'm not sure. Might have been. So he has a very interesting view. Well, in any case, you have these two cultures. And the question is, if one of those cultures is essentially the focal point for collective bargaining that they're trying to impose on the total faculty, you really exacerbate the two cultures problem. So that, I think, was an underlying theme. And then the third category, which is very different from these first two, is that the concept of general education, of trying to do integration before you provided in-depth exposure to any of the disciplines, was perceived by many of us as sort of wrong-headed. You've got to have something to integrate before you can teach integration. And when basic college got started, it was looking at pulling together the basic techniques and understanding of economics and social science, of the natural sciences, of humanities, and then the whole business of use of English, which was the old ATL. Well, what had happened over the period of the development of what was a good concept of taking a more integrated view of the fundamentals that you use, was taking the idea of integration and letting that become the dominant theme of basic college. And many of us felt that you can't integrate until you have something to integrate. And so many of the youngsters coming in out of the high schools were getting weaker and weaker in terms of their fundamentals. So you had kids coming in here that hadn't mastered fundamentals in high school. Come here, they're not taught fundamentals in their first exposure, but taught integration. Integration of what? So it, the system that was good in concept when you had very first-rate high school graduates coming into the college to start, and now you integrate their basic fleshing out of their fundamental principles and skills and techniques and so on. That was all very good, very well thought through. It was an integrated set. It dovetailed nicely with the products they were working with, the young people coming in, faculty committed to the idea. Now you move up and you get a group of people who are looking at the need for integrating the different areas of study. And not that most of the scholars on campus disagreed with that, but you can't integrate until you've got some disciplines to integrate. And so the concept was the integrative study should be upper level courses, not in the basic college.
You know, it was upside down.
It was upside down, yeah. And so two class faculty had emerged. Faculty that were in the basic college began to pursue the integrative studies as the dominant theme, abandoning essentially any responsibility for teaching principles, teaching the basic skills and so on, which were being more and more poorly done in the high schools. The thing just became a, a poorly designed set for what had happened in the intervening 30 years. So that coupled with this unionization, the two classes working together, just became an overpowering thing that we've got to now rethink undergraduate education. And if you've looked at the CREW report, which you should really look at, which is the son of basic college, and I think it's a better concept, because it recognizes that you must start with the skills, because they're sure as hell not adequately mastered by the average kids, the best kids. You know, college can't hurt them. They're so damn good that...
I've always said the bright kids learn in spite of you, not because of you.
Exactly. No. So the CREW report, in a sense, is the next generation. Maybe it would be the third generation, because the first generation, which I think was very good, was basic college, of trying to integrate that set. And Hannah's view, you know, was that you shouldn't have engineers that can't use English. And you shouldn't have people in the arts and letters and music that don't know a damn thing about natural sciences or social sciences. In other words, early specialization is a lousy idea, and I agree with that. And I don't think we've not departed from that at all at Michigan State. As a matter of fact, what we've done here is to take the integration of knowledge, which is one of the big weaknesses, I think, and I'm not persuaded yet that we've solved the problem, where we have a proposed curriculum that's just really being talked about, and not much of it's in existence yet. But we've got to go back and build the basic language skills and the basic mathematical skills, because the high schools simply are failing to do that job. Now, let's assume the best. And let's assume that the colleges of education will really turn out some first-rate people.
Some problems.
Well, there's family problems.
That's not where the problem is either.
All right.
The problem is with schools.
School boards?
Mm-hmm. I never thought I would say this until I became a superintendent. I could never understand some of the things that were going on until I got there. And it goes back to basically what I was taught here at Michigan State. You basically have three choices in life when there's a problem. You either bend, you accept it, get out, or get in and make a change.
Uh-huh.
And I chose to get in and make a change. And as I got through the process, I came to the realization that when you allow just anybody to be on the Board of Education, then you get just anything.
Yeah.
And you have people that are coming on boards who are there because they have an axe to grind.
Yeah.
You have people that come on board that have absolutely no grasp of what education is about anymore. It is a true profession.
Oh, absolutely.
It's like taking doctors and turning them over to the mob. And that's basically what's happened.
Yeah.
I've got a school board right now, quite frankly, where their attitude, and they told me this rather openly, is the hell with the state minimum standards until the year that we are inspected, which is every 5 years in Ohio. During that year, we move up to the standards. But then once the state's gone, you drop them again because we can save money. Now, what do you do with it? You're getting the end product.
Yeah.
And they don't understand or want to understand, or even, I don't think they even care to understand that you can't work with a halfway prepared kid.
Well, and the nation can't compete in an intensifying international competition with that kind of a society.
Yeah, see, the whole problem right now is that the focus is on the wrong people.
Exactly.
It's on the servants,
yeah.
The public servants. It's not there. It's at the board level. On the,
yeah. Well, it's the people. We have a society that's spoiled.
You said it.
Yeah, man. So they haven't really thought about what it takes to be a competitive citizen in the modern world, and they're going to learn damn fast.
Let me ask you this. Knowing the situation as it is now on the secondary level, because I'm in complete concurrence with you that the quality of the secondary student is worse
dropped.
Than it was when I was here.
Yeah, it's more polarized, I would think. Two things have happened. The very brightest are still as good and maybe even better than they ever were.
Agreed.
The middle part of the curve, the great center part, shifted down scale several points.
Not because they don't want a better site, but because they are not being given the opportunity.
Right.
How would you feel, if you were in a position to take a model like the University College as it was envisioned, say, after its first revision in the early 50s, what would you do different to it to make it work now, considering the student population? And correct me if I'm wrong, in essence what you're saying is, in addition to the faculty problems, the biggest problem has been the change in your people you're serving,
The people that you're serving were coming in less well prepared than they were earlier. And the faculty members were pushing toward the integration side of it, which is a premature focal point.
Let's say that we took the faculty issue out of it and just dealt with the model of a separate college,
mm-hmm.
Administratively, so that it had the flexibility to move a lot faster than if it were part of each individual department. And you now know that your student population has changed, unfortunately, in general, in the negative way.
Mm-hmm.
How would you take that model and possibly use it?
Well, there are a couple of dimensions to it. One has to do, you can't divorce it quite from the faculty thing because of the two worlds.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a group of faculty that only teach undergraduates and teach very heavy teaching loads, they were
mm-hmm.
dealing with 15 credit hours.
I wondered about that.
Heavy teaching loads, and so they have very little opportunity for real scholarship. If you're going to do that kind of thing, we have the same problem with the residential colleges, where again, you're dominated, these are predominantly undergraduate teachers. It attracts people that like to teach and they're good at it.
Mm-hmm.
So you've got all of that, which is beneficial. Now what you have to do is to take that group of people that are working harder at undergraduate teaching than their counterparts in the basic disciplines and the professional schools who are expected to have major scholarly output. Now you got to figure out a way to give these people total freedom from teaching for at least a term. And, you know, the sabbatical idea is 1 in 7. That's too infrequent to maintain scholarly activity. And it may well be that you don't need a full half year. In a quarter system, you know, you could give one quarter off every 3 years. So that, but what you have to do is to do that or give them some kind of summer scholarly opportunity that keeps them away from the very, very heavy load so they can really get back and retool their scholarship.
Because what would you think of a process of maybe rotation between the two cultures?
Well, it's good from the perspective of the people doing the undergraduate work to get off and spend a year or two in the scholarly work, and some of the individuals have actually done that. But it's very hard to go back. Very hard to go back because it's a tougher life. You've now got to cope with all of the, you know, the day-to-day problems of young kids who are not all fully committed to scholarly pursuits. There's a lot of the me generation out there, and so it's very tough to do. I think it's better not to try to mix them. I used to think, and as a matter of fact, we used to talk about trying to essentially do the, and that's what's happening now, you see. We've dismantled that group of people that only taught undergraduates, and the presumption is that you're going to be able to get additional teaching activity out of the scholarly community. Well, you get some, because, you know, a lot of people really are more turned on by teaching than they are by research and scholarly activity. So there will be a subset, a self-identified subset coming out, and the next 4 to 5 years here at Michigan State will be very interesting to watch from a social and individual perspective, to watch the emergence of that new set of undergraduate teachers, predominantly undergraduate teachers. And if they're not smart, and if they don't provide these sort of mini sabbaticals on a more regular basis, either every summer or every other year or every third year, give them the summer plus a term, and it should be either spring or fall, so they've got almost a 6 month. See, now we're going into the semester system.
Yeah, I was kind of sad to hear that. To be honest with you, I always loved the quarter system.
Yeah.
I felt I got a lot more and it was more intensified.
Yeah.
But that's, I just know I'm built different than other people. You give me constant challenge and high activity and I thrive, but if you give me a semester, it's too laid back.
Well, I like it. I grew up under it, so I carry those prejudices, I'm sure. Well, in any case, I really do think that you're going to end up with a self-identified set of undergraduate teachers who really love to do that. And I find it very stimulating. I like undergraduate teaching. But I don't want to do it 12 months of the year in and year out, because it grinds you down. You just finally, you get to the point where you feel the place owes you something, because you know you're committing more than 8 hours a day and more than your colleagues are committing.
If you're going to be a good teacher, you have to. I remember only 12 was like being a teacher.
Yeah.
And you'll burn out.
Exactly. And so you got to have this period of exposure to a scholarly life for a while, but not moving totally into that world. It's got to be recognized as a respite, a rebirth, a renewal activity to go back with all of that new energy and so on and put it to work. So we haven't designed, I don't think, a successful model to do that. Now, some of the small liberal arts colleges have it very well. So if we're smart, what we'll do is to look at the Kalamazoo colleges and the Oberlins and that kind of a place, and try to build a model where you're taking your best undergraduate teachers and using them fully in this process. And I like the new concept of CREW, in which you spend a lot of time mastering the skills of English, really make sure that they can produce, because if you're not doing it in high school, you've got to do it here or you're crippled for life, really. And putting mastering of quantitative skills in there as well. See, that was missing in the original basic college concept. The quantification piece was not perceived to be essential to...
I noticed that in one particular department when I was here, the humanities department. The natural science department, to be honest with you, it was a great time of exploration, because I saw things in forms of science that I couldn't even imagine in high school. Great experience.
Yeah, well, you were here at a time when it was still pretty much in its original set, you see.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
What year did you...
I graduated in 65.
Yeah.
I was one of those who was a professional student.
When did you start?
I had started in 60, and quite frankly, I can actually blame somebody for all this. I was one of those rare people that was sober on the night of the graduation of high school, and during commencement, we had a two-star general from the Air Force come and speak, and I'd never seen anyone with a star on his shoulder.
Mm-hmm.
So I paid attention, and he was one of these people in 1959, 60, pushing Renaissance men.
Oh, yeah.
Which, in the time of highly specialized people. And
sure.
I said, that's what I want to be. And I came here, and I graduated with something like 165 credits. And
mm-hmm.
What it was is I was having such a good time learning, and I took everything from Oriental history to modern dance. I was having such a good time that one day my father said to me, gee, next year your brother goes to college. Do you have any plans for next year? And I went,
uh-oh.
I looked and sat down with my advisor, and lo and behold, I had completed majors in history and math.
Mm-hmm.
With about five different minors. And mm-hmm. I said, well, I've got to get out of here, because it's time for my brother. It's time I grow up. Quit learning. Go out and earn a salary or something. So I took my degree in math
mm-hmm.
and had hoped to go into the military, but because of eye problems, was not allowed to.
Mm-hmm.
I had a cousin in education said, I noticed that one of your minors was education. Why did you do that? I said, well, one of my officers told me it'd be good for me. That's how I did a lot of this.
Yeah, sure.
I listened to every grown-up that was around me and every professor.
And so he said, why don't you try teaching? So I went into Cleveland schools and taught academically talented, fell absolutely in love with education.
Oh, yeah.
Been here ever since.
Good, good.
And then the people up here at Michigan State, because I still miss it, and I still wear my class right now. But I really appreciate everything you've given me. You've given me some insights here that have got me really thinking now, because I have heard some of you, of the three areas in different forms,
mm-hmm.
but I can see now I've got a lot of thinking to do.
Mm-hmm. So there was nothing wrong with the original concept. It was a good idea, and in its time, as you know, it turned out very good people. But it concentrated on working with the integrated skills level, tried to put them together, but didn't abandon the teaching of skills. And as it matured, they got more and more mesmerized by what was clearly a lack, which is a lack of integration. But being fed a population of people who had nothing to integrate.
Yeah. And I have to agree that I saw this starting to occur in the late 60s when I was teaching, where the family started breaking up.
Yeah.
And I felt that there's where the initial problem was, and I still feel that that's true, because when you have families breaking up, you have people not paying as close attention, and you get the low quality on boards
mm-hmm.
that we now have.
Yeah, it's a fascinating
picture. To the point where, unfortunately, I have a feeling we're going to have to go to a form of appointed boards, politically appointed.
Well, yeah, that's how you address all of these problems. We're looking at it a little bit differently. You see, the land-grant university was really invented back in the middle 1850s, not by academics, but by the people of the state who were critical of the academics of the day, who were ignoring the needs of the people, the large block of people. And if you look at what was in their heads, it was kind of a human enablement machine. How do you take a great body of young people being turned off and enable them to move ahead? But more than that, it was pretty obvious within the first... Have you read Madison Kuhn's History of Michigan State?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Within the first 15 years or so, it was pretty obvious that if you were going to move the emerging knowledge coming out of sciences into agriculture, which was the dominant industry of the state at the time, you had to do something other than graduating kids, because it's too slow a process. And so they began to try to move information out for farmers, and the farmers couldn't care less for what these academics were telling them.
Yeah, it hasn't changed.
Well, in a sense it has, because the way in which we learned to do it changed. Obviously, no family's going to bet the farm and their next year's well-being on some untried, unproven theory. So the whole concept of extension grew out of demonstrating the efficacy of whatever it was they were looking at. So they put together a whole series of things that we think of today as lifelong education and
mm-hmm.
teaching by demonstration and all of the things that we've sort of now put together in theory, which were worked out empirically back in those days. But that system emerged then as a human enablement and economic development machine. And that's what land-grant universities really are.
Well, see, you had two things going at the time. You had a population that demanded more education. And you also had the professor's generation coming out of the German school that said you serve your nation and your state by getting fully involved. Now we have a general population that says, I want it easy and I want it now. And a professional staff that says, I want to specialize in such an obscure, narrow specialization that when I do my dissertation, it'll collect dust. And the more dust it collects, the more I am honored by my peers.
Well,
no, you know,
yeah, it's a caricature, but nevertheless,
it's
an
oversimplified caricature,
sure.
But it makes a point.
The land-grant university, because it grew out of an ag history, integrated knowledge into the real world, which are multidisciplinary. there are no unidisciplinary real problems out there generally. They're multidisciplinary. And so the Ag Experiment Station evolved, you see, by the 1890s, in which you integrated the specialists together to address the problem set. And we're not doing that today. And the problems of society are very, very different from what they were in agriculture. Even agriculture's primary problem is not technology of agriculture. It's something very, very different, and that's the survival of the farm family is a producing unit out there, where half or more of their income typically is off the farm income. And you've got all of the investment in agriculture not looking at the well-being of rural Michigan, but looking at what technologies farmers use for about 1.5% of the total population, which is politically non-survivable. So the whole system needs to be readjusted, but this human enablement trajectory, I did an analysis here recently looking at where we have specialists, looking at how do you keep more and more people into the development trajectories as opposed to letting them fall out into welfare or into the corrections or into Medicaid. We've got people working at every level in that enablement stream, but there's no integration of it. They're all working as individual entrepreneurs. And the social services agencies are so designed that their rewards, their promotions and everything come based on the size client loads they have. Well, tax revolts are built out of a perception that there's no way to curtail the exponentially growing demand for these services of welfare, corrections, Medicaid, Medicare, all of those things, and fundamentally they're correct. There's nothing in place to slow up in an integrated gestalt, nothing in place to slow up the new client streams going into these safety net programs.
And they're not productive.
Right, and you're fencing them out of the economy instead of teaching them how to survive in the economy.
Amen.
So, you know, the Land-Grant University simply has to reorient to look at this, and we've got some major stuff underway now, finally.
Well, see, I've always felt that the best thing ever happened at universities anywhere was the Land-Grant movement.
Oh, yeah, it's
one of the questions I did on my dissertation was on the Land-Grant movement, and I've become a firm believer in it. It's tragic to me that so many other universities have picked up the mottos, but not the philosophy.
Yeah, not the philosophy. You have to integrate knowledge to put it to work, and you got to have feedback loops from the people that you're trying to serve, because you can't allow arrogant faculty to dictate to people, because it's not that type of society.
I also think that in my particular field of education, that the departments of education and universities have got to start screaming about what's happening at the secondary level.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think our College of Education, as you probably are aware, is partly on the right track. I think we're over-expecting what they can do. So much of what needs to be done is not within the school, as you pointed out. It's a societal problem. And we don't have an integrated strategy for addressing that societal problem yet.
Well, that's one of my hopes. If I find the university crazy enough to take me on as a professor, that's one of the things I'm going to be my cause of love.